Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Biotech Podcast, where we illuminate life science career opportunities outside of academia through the experiences of those who have been there before. For updates about upcoming guests, follow us on social media and visit us at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com to check out our full catalog of episodes. My name is Roshan Chickermain, and I'm joined here with our newest co-host.
I'm Cynthia Steinhardt.
Our guest today is Dr. Camille Delebecq. He is a man of many titles. He's a co-founder and CEO of Affinier, a startup that sustainably processes raw agriculture into plant-based meats and even optimizes the flavor profiles of various foods using the latest advances in fermentation and enzymology. He's also the founder and CEO of Soil Bio, a startup that aims to develop proprietary mixtures of microbes that enrich the soil with nutrients and improve crop yields. And additionally, he's the founder and partner of Synbio Consulting, where he works with companies, governmental institutions, university tech transfer offices, and investment funds to assist in the deployment of novel biotechnologies. Camille, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
So could you just provide us with a brief overview of those three companies that you're working at, Affinier, Soil Bio, and Synbio Consulting?
Thanks for the intro. If you think about the time I spend in those companies, it's really, you know, maybe like 90% of my time is with Affinier. Maybe like 5% of my time is with Synbio Consulting, and 5% is with Soil Bio currently. So Synbio Consulting was really the second company that I ever founded, and that was right after my PhD in synthetic biology. And so I kind of like, you know, phased out a little bit some of these services that I used to provide. And so nowadays, you know, I sit in a few advisory boards and I take like a few interesting projects here and there. But yeah, so most of my time is with Affinier. And Affinier is really nowadays, and, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about that because it's, you know, it's been a winding road, of course. But nowadays, it's mostly a contract research organization that helps, you know, small, big, medium companies develop new types of natural fermented food products and ingredients with, as you were saying, a focus on animal replacement products. And then Soil Bio is a new addition to to this list, and it's basically a spin-off from Affinier. At some point throughout my career, I had the opportunity to work more around the intersection between biotechnology and agriculture as the CSO of, I'm sure we'll talk about that, but as a CSO of a medium company in the Houston area. And so that was a number of years ago, and we had the opportunity with Affinier to work on an agriculture-related project. And at the time, it made more sense to spin this out from Affinier, have Affinier still focus on food projects, and have Soil Bio, you know, focus on agriculture.
Awesome. So much of the work you do now at Affinier and even at Soil Bio, as you mentioned, involves applying microbiology and synthetic biology to agriculture or other end markets. And even in your master's degree and PhD, they seem really geared towards those sort of three disciplines as an overlap. What initially sparked your interest in microbiology, synthetic biology, agriculture, and putting those things together?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the first interest was around, you know, environmental sustainability. Especially when it comes to food and food production. And I think that really was triggered really early on by, it's a bit of a cliche, but, you know, I grew up watching the Cousteau movies, and I think that was really the trigger. But, you know, later on I decided to study agronomical engineering, and that was my first kind of like background and degree. And along this path, I came across synthetic biology, and I found the intersection really, really interesting in that, you know, fermentation, biotechnology, and genetic engineering can really, you know, solve all the big challenges around food sustainability and food production. So it came fairly naturally, you know, it's, I think it's those are areas where biotechnology kind of like a really, really big impact. But as you were saying, they're not necessarily the first areas that people think about when they think about biotechnology.
So stepping back into the beginning of your career, how did your studies lead into your first company? You co-founded your first startup, Omics, near the end of your PhD. Did it come directly out of your work, or was there some other inspiration?
I think we have to also touch about, you know, kind of like the early interest in entrepreneurship. So even, you know, even before starting my PhD, I knew that I was really interested in, you know, food and ag and synthetic biology. But from my first research experiences, I realized I was really interested in the commercialization side of those technologies. I mean, R&D was super interesting and still is, you know, a big part of my daily job. But I felt that, you know, the bottleneck was oftentimes more on the commercialization side. So I almost did another PhD that was in business and management of innovation, tell you the truth. But I decided to go with a scientific PhD to really get a good grasp on, you know, the science, really. And so during my PhD, I decided to keep on exploring the business aspects on the side of, you know, doing my main, you know, project, my lab work. And so I joined the biotech club at Harvard, where I was I became a director at some point, and I also joined an entrepreneur network called SLP, and really is what kind of like started my exploration of entrepreneurship. And at some point, I reconnected with an old friend who had a technology in mind that he had been working on during his master's and really wanted to commercialize it. And around, you know, antibiotic production, and that became kind of like the starting ground for Omics, which was the first real exploration into entrepreneurship.
As you mentioned, you chose to get a scientific PhD and got an informal entrepreneurship education by taking MBA classes, as well as working in the Harvard Technology Development Office, being a part of the Harvard Biotech Club, and doing an internship before creating your first company. What would you say PhD students interested in entrepreneurship could gain from the scientific education versus those entrepreneurship-related experiences?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the bet that I did, and I think, you know, I still would do this bet, is the fact that getting business skills is much easier and much easier to do yourself, or to kind of like bootstrap in a way than getting, you know, like a profound scientific expertise. So, you know, I always think that scientific PhDs are really interesting and really key in developing those skills. And, you know, but if you think about the traditional you know, graduate program, it's really not geared towards helping people get out of academia. And so all these skills and all these experiences, somehow you need to, you know, build them yourself one way or another. And so if you look at my journey, you know, I was spending most of my days in the labs and long hours. But at the same time, as you were saying, you know, I was seeking those experiences. I was lucky to take a summer off to work for a VC firm as an intern. And, you know, I was also lucky to take some classes at the business school. But all that, you know, somehow you need to do yourself. You need to find those, you know, those things that are going to build your skill set and your experience along the way.
You co-founded your first startup company, and that was Omics. How did that even come together in the first place? And what was the idea behind the company?
So, you know, I think the desire to found a company came even before kind of like the specific technology that became Omics. And, you know, it's actually often what, you know, VC firms or say that, you know, the founding team is very, very important. And I had this great friend who was also like an excellent scientist and an excellent entrepreneur that, you know, was also really eager to explore synthetic biology entrepreneurship. And so this team was almost kind of like founded before we really had the specific project that we wanted to try to explore. And I think it was also deeply rooted in the belief that, you know, the experience is almost more valuable than, you know, wherever this journey takes us. And we just really wanted to experience what launching a startup means, and what, you know, bootstrapping and fundraising would look like. And so this technology came from a lab in New Zealand where my co-founder had worked during his master's, and it was like around a very interesting fungi strain that could produce a whole range of novel antibiotics. And you know, we actively explored this area, this idea. We pushed it, we pitched it. Ultimately, there were some IP challenges that we were not really able to resolve. So it never, you know, blossomed into a big company or big, you know, startup. But it was really like kind of like the first baby steps into getting to know what it takes to get something started.
Yeah, so you mentioned that this was an experience to really go out in the field and try your hand at starting a company. It may or may not work. We hope it works, certainly. But I'm sure there are many valuable lessons you learned in that process that you've now leveraged into your later companies, which are going. So my question to you is, how did that experience of starting your first company, Omics, inform your future startup experiences?
That's a great question. You know, I think you know, starting is always the hardest thing. We're never ready, or never ready enough to start something. And so we kind of like bursted through this barrier with Omics and realized that, you know, it was more of a psychological barrier oftentimes than a real one, and that, you know, better than anything, we thought that being confronted to feedback from the community as early as possible would be invaluable. And so I think it's something that I took with me in those later companies, you know, really kind of like fairly early on, seeking feedback, and almost like there's a book that really inspired me at the time. It's the Lean Startup book, and it's this idea of like, you know, really being exposed to feedback and both from your peers and your potential customers, and getting as fast as possible to MVP, a minimal viable product, and, you know, failing as early as possible if failing is what's going to happen. And so that's, you know, certainly something that I've taken with me along the rest of the rides and up until now.
Soon after founding your first startup, you created SynBio Consulting, and you began to work with a nonprofit for mentoring up-and-coming business leaders. Before this, you'd had a variety of experiences, such as working for Pure Tech Ventures or being the project manager in the life sciences division at UNESCO. So you'd obviously honed your business skills to some level where you felt like you're at the point you were ready to consult. What made you want to start a consulting company as opposed to working for, say, a consulting company? And what were some of the signs for you that you were actually ready to make that leap into being that consultant?
Yeah. So, you know, I touched upon this search that I had during my PhD, you know, alongside my lab work, my scientific work, to build and explore, you know, the world of entrepreneurship and the world of industry. And at some point I came across the fact that the tech transfer office at Harvard was hiring grad students and postdocs to help them explore and assess their technology portfolio, and also, you know, help them commercialize some of those technologies. So that's really how I got into consulting. It's by starting to work for the tech transfer office. And along with this work, so I gained some skills, some, you know, kind of like a better understanding of how this type of projects can might go along. But you know, I also realized that synthetic biology at the time was still very new, and that you know a lot of mature industries were starting to have real questions around how those new biotechnologies were going to impact their business. So there was a demand for kind of like, yes, scientific consultant, but that also had like a real understanding of the business challenges in helping them identify, assess those kind of like up and coming technologies and how those were going to impact their businesses. And like fairly early on, I focused on everything but pharma. And actually, you know, those engagements also grew into working with government bodies. So a big project with the European Commission, for example, and things like that. Yeah.
You also served in a different consulting role by being on the advisory board of the European Commission. The European Commission being a part of the executive branch of the European Union that creates policies and administers the budgets for programs such as agriculture, fisheries, and research for the member countries of the European Union. To start, how did you get involved with the European Commission? And can you talk about what the job entailed?
Yeah, so two things that I want to address. The first thing is that when I talk to students, you know, one thing that people tend to think is that, you know, things just fall on your laps. And I think the journey as an entrepreneur is one of being very, very proactive to make things happen for you. And that was the case with the European Commission, in that there was a very public call for experts to be involved in this committee that was going to assess you know, the potential for synthetic biology, especially when it comes to the concerns around health and consumer safety. So that was the first thing that I guess I can talk a bit more about this project in particular. But most of my project, most of the things came from you know, actively seeking those opportunities, and while there's some chance obviously involved as well in those being there somewhere. The other thing that I wanted to mention it a bit earlier, but when you look at a lot of the entrepreneurs' journeys, and that's certainly the case on my side, it's absolutely not a linear journey. A lot of the things that I've done kind of like crisscross each other and kind of like, you know, happen in parallel, and kind of like the, you know, the funding and the financial security coming from one thing kind of like enables the next one and all that. And I think it's important to realize also. The European Commission was a very, very interesting project. It's a project that I was involved with continuously for about 2 years, where, you know, I was part of a team of 8 experts and coming from all over the world with different expertise in different corners of synthetic biology. But we were tasked with, you know, writing 3 white papers for the European Commissions and helping them assess the current state of the art of synthetic biology, with the first very, something that seems trivial, but that was not really set at the time, with the question, which is, you know, what's a good definition for synthetic biology? What is synthetic biology? All the way to kind of like the current state and kind of like a future potential for the field and the potential impact they might have on, you know, consumer products and the potential concerns that there might be also around those applications. So, and then, you know, ultimately recommendations around funding to kind of like leave some of this uncertainty that there might be around specific areas. So it was very interesting. I was brought to Brussels and Luxembourg every month and a half to work for a few days with the team, and everything that we published actually also went through public consultations, which was a really interesting exercise where, you know, we collected feedback from the public for a number of weeks and then addressed all of them into kind of like the finalized white papers. Yeah, that was really interesting.
Were they more interested in getting up to date in the technical details of synthetic biology, or was it more of the ethical implications? What specific angles were they interested in?
It's really both. It's really kind of like understanding what has changed, what makes synthetic biology potentially different than traditional genetic engineering. What are kind of like the newest development in like technical development in the field, and what are the ones that we might expect in the next few years, and how might those be applied? And then comes the question of like, well, you know, are there specific uncertainties when it comes to specifically to health for the final consumers? And then if so, then, you know, how do we leave those uncertainties, possibly by, you know, funneling specific R&D budgets to address those outstanding questions? Yeah.
Wow. And it's really up to you guys to use more your science and ethical brain than your business brain and hopefully give them the best advice.
Yeah. It was very interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then could you tell us for other people, students, you know, at our PhD level who might be interested in being a part of science policy, you know, how could they, like you said, you know, take the opportunity as they see it?
So I think it really depends on the different fields. There are two angles. There's one that is really kind of like grassroots activism, which is, I think, is still very important, and it's very insightful also for us as scientists to not kind of like lock ourselves in our ivory towers, but kind of like really keeping in touch with what's going on the ground. So activism is important, and then there's like a number of centers or nonprofit that are actively exploring those interfaces between science and policy, and those are, I think, the right doors to knock at. I would go from there.
So one of the things that you had mentioned previously is that you, for a brief time, were chief scientific officer at this company, Microbes Biosciences, in Houston, Texas. And you did this before being a full-time entrepreneur, really, in the companies that you're operating today. We're curious to know, how did your role as chief scientific officer at this company compare to what might be the roles of a PI or the roles of a PhD or postdoc?
That's a really good question. I was brought into this company that was not in crisis mode, but kind of, you know. So it's, you know, as if a new PI is brought into, I don't know, salvage lab and you know, think about how you might still get funding and grants in the future and potentially retailer your scientific priorities and think about who you're going to hire, who you might potentially fire, how do you make the most of the situation. So in this case, it's a company that was funded in the mid-90s. So in the Houston area, as you were saying, initially it's a company that was developing microbial products for the oil and gas industry. So it turns out you can use microbes as a way to liquefy oil and extract more, especially out of old mature wells. And that was their main business up until the mid-late, 2000s. And the other side business also around bioremediation. How do you use microbes as a tool to depollute contaminated areas? So this business was going down, and I think the oil in general at the time was starting to go down, and they wanted to kind of like leverage their existing scientific expertise and IP portfolio to potentially develop products for agriculture. And in agriculture, there was something very interesting that was happening and still happening right now, is the fact that people have figured out that plants do have a microbiome, just like we do, and that you can enrich in specific beneficial microbes that are going to help, you know, different types of crops grow better and bring more yields, resist different types of stresses. So there's this whole new branch of agriculture that's looking at replacing or at least complementing chemical fertilizers with microbial inoculants, they call them. So that was my role, like being, you know, kind of like brought in as a consultant initially to solve for this challenge. And that evolved fairly quickly into kind of like a full-time gig, where I became the CSO of this company. And my role really was, you know, doing the interface between, you know, commercialization and the science and the manufacturing. So it was understanding the needs of our clients, which at the time was one of the biggest, you know, chemical fertilizer company in the US, was our main client. So understanding the specific pain point and the specific needs that they had around, you know, specific products that we could potentially develop for them. And then, you know, translating that into an R&D program to develop those products and then, you know, scale them up and manufacture them. So it's really kind of like making the bridge between those two worlds.
Yeah. What was it like transitioning the company through that pivot? Because as you mentioned, the company was working on microbial solutions, but the end market was in the oil industry. Then you have to shift towards agriculture. And the question is, number one, what specifically do we do in agriculture? And number two, how can we retool the workforce to work in a completely different end market? What was that process like?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. To really understand, you know, where we could have the most impact, we heavily relied on our commercial partners. So we're lucky in that we were approached by this big company that, you know, specific demands and specific challenges. And that really kind of like enlightened us into, you know, kind of like directed us or funneled us towards, you know, a number of specific areas of opportunities that then could drive, you know, the R&D. And then when it comes to the R&D itself, you know, the company had a number of specific skill sets when it comes to isolating, screening for specific microbial strains that was still very, very relevant. Had a specific skill set around manufacturing at large scale those microbes. And also had a skill set around, you know, stabilizing those microbes and shipping them to the end product. So it was, yeah, really kind of like repurposing the whole company, but relied as much as possible on the commercial partner.
So it was almost a matter of finding those new partners and then being able to meet their needs, and then Exactly. That's the direction you move the company now.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah.
Why, after getting into the CSO role at Microbes Biosciences, did you then decide to switch back into full-time entrepreneurship?
Yeah, and so basically what happened, so now you're starting to get kind of like this picture of the continuum of my journey, that I, you know, started doing a bit of consulting towards the end of my PhD, and that became, you know, my consulting company, Symbio Consulting, and then one engagement became, you know, my job at Microbes Biosciences and Biosciences as the CSO. And towards the end of Microbes, basically the relationship with the commercial partner became so tight that I felt we kind of like had done our job. The company was in early talks about being acquired. And, you know, it was going to be rolled into the bigger company. And I started to think about, you know, what would be next for me if I wanted to jump into potentially working in a big company like that, or if I wanted to stay with kind of like the early slash mid stage of starting and growing companies. And if anything, this experience in this company kind of like reignited my wish to stay involved with early stage companies. So I think it was something that had kind of like matured kind of like alongside Microbes. I decided to explore and develop some of the, or source some of the early technologies and some of the potential early projects that we'd be working on while I was still working at Microbes Life Sciences. So again, there's kind of like a continuum. But basically what was happening was that there was a shift that was happening on the US market. A shift on the consumer side. People were starting to ask for more natural products, less processed, clean label, a wish for naturality, a wish for more plant-based products and replacements to animal-based products. So that was one of the things that was happening on the consumer side. And the other thing that was happening also that was interesting was the fact that people were starting to change their minds towards fermentation and towards microbes specifically. You know, ever since Pasteur, basically, people have been at war with microbes. But that started to change in the early mid-2010s with, I think, especially in the US, with the rise of craft brewing and kombucha and all that. So there was that was happening on the consumer side. And the other thing was that, you know, of course we have like a really long heritage with fermented food products in many different cultures, but a lot of those fermented food products are very simple. I mean, very complex, but very simple, in that a lot of them rely on spontaneous fermentation, and that, you know, we don't really understand fully what's going on, what strains contribute to what. And so there was an opportunity there to bring on some of the kind of like the newer biotechnology tools to really transform fermentation into an a la carte tool that could help make better plant-based products while still answering this demand for natural processes and clean label and all that. So, I launched Affiner really through, I guess the trigger was being accepted into an accelerator program, which brought some funding and also brought some access to lab space specifically for this, for the early stages of this project. So got accepted into IndieBio. I'm sure many people here are familiar with IndieBio, but it's nowadays, I think, it's the biggest biotech accelerator program with programs, cohorts that run both in Europe, in the UK, and in the US with a chapter in New York City and a chapter in the Bay Area. But anyways, yeah, so we were accepted into the first ever cohort of IndieBio. And that was the trigger to really launch Affiner. The idea initially with Affiner was to launch a line of consumer products, because I didn't think that the bigger, while there were trends that I mentioned, I didn't think that the big food companies were quite aware of those trends yet, or at least not quite ready to acting upon them. So the idea was to start B2C and launch interesting, innovative consumer products, and leverage that almost as a marketing tool to, at some point, get B2B interest. And so that's what we did. We started with like something that people use every day, specifically coffee. And coffee was interesting to us because there was, at the time, still is now, like kind of like a trend towards higher quality coffee. People were starting to shift how they consume coffee and were starting to care about not just the caffeine kick, but also the flavor profile and potentially the health benefits. And that's called the third wave of coffee. And also what was really interesting with coffee is that it's obviously like a huge commodity. It's one of the most traded commodity in the world in terms of volume. And the early stages of coffee processing do involve a fermentation. And so it's basically a fermentation that happens at the farm level, and people, you know, pick the coffee cherries from the coffee tree. And the first step is to remove the pulp around the seeds. And in most of the time, farmers just dump the coffee cherries into big tanks of water and let them naturally ferment as a way to remove the pulp. And then the bean is dried and then sent to the roasters, and that makes coffee. Anyway, so the whole coffee industry had known forever that fermentation was such an important step impacting the quality of the final product, but no one had really looked into how we could harvest that and leverage that as a controllable step to really kind of like bring coffee to new heights, be it on the flavor side or even on the functional side, thinking about, you know, coffee that might be healthier, etc. So it was kind of like a really interesting first project that had big potential. It's a product that people share that is fairly high end. And so it was an interesting first project to kind of like put our name out there. And we launched this product through Kickstarter that was, you know, fully funded within 6 hours. The idea was to, again, be as visible as possible. And if possible, have our early customers be people that would be very interested in the science behind the process and also being involved with potentially the next projects that we were going to develop. So we were fully funded within 6 hours and we grew the business from there. We launched another few consumer products, and with time we had more and more of those, you know, small, medium and bigger size companies knocking on our door and asking for our expertise and helping them develop new types of fermented food products or fermented ingredients. And so slowly but surely, Affiner became more of a B2B company, more of a contract research organization, if you want, developing fermentation processes for those clients, with a specific interest in, one is obviously, you know, how do you make plant-based foods more attractive as a replacement for animal product? And the other one is, we have like a big problem worldwide with food waste, and can we also do something about that? And so so a lot of our projects are around using fermentation as a tool to create a plant-based alternative to animal proteins. And on the other side, we also have like a lot of projects around upcycling side products coming from the food industry and transforming those side products using fermentations into generally protein powders that can be reused in the food industry.
Yeah, that's such an interesting strategy that you took with getting Affiner started, because you were thinking, we see signs that fermented foods would make great products, but the incumbents are not necessarily interested in immediately adopting such a process. So what we need to do is prove the market with some consumer products, and then maybe that attracts some interest, some B2B interest. It's such an interesting strategy.
And also it also raises another point, which is like another way to think about growing a biotechnology startup. You might have noticed that something I didn't talk about was raising money. We did raise some money early on, like a modest amount. Going fairly quickly to commercializing products gave us the flexibility to be fairly independent and grow the company in the green without having to rely on continuously fundraising. So that's something that I really wanted to do, was, you know, build a sustainable company and finding a business plan that would be sustainable. And that's what we've achieved.
Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned is that fermentation processes have been applied to food processing for a while, but it was a little bit of luck. It was a little bit more random. But today we have a lot of technologies, and maybe we can be a little bit more intentional with, if we add this certain mix of microbes, we can change the food in certain ways. Is that kind of more of the direction that Afanera is taking specifically with changing the flavor profile of a food is really being data driven and saying, if we have this specific mix, you can achieve these sorts of results, like consistently. Yeah.
Exactly. And beyond that is also the opportunity to extend and start applying fermentation onto, food or biomasses that are not necessarily traditionally fermented to develop new products or develop new ingredients. Very data-driven. And it's also, the opportunity was also to kind of like build a bridge between the biotechnology world and the flavor chemistry world. And so my co-founder is actually a flavor chemist by training. And so that was like a real opportunity to kind of like build a bridge between those two worlds.
We've talked about how you're involved in agriculture and food, but are there any other applications of microbiology in those industries or outside of those industries that you've thought about or heard about that you find exciting now?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many low-hanging fruits in other areas as well. And we need people looking at those too. On the food side, I talked about Afanera's approach, which is very much around kind of like tailoring and enhancing an existing biomass or an existing food product. There's another approach, which is, de novo fermentation or ex nihilo fermentation, where you have like, for example, a yeast strain that is genetically engineered to transform, sugar into, let's say, like a milk protein. And that's another approach that is super interesting. It's another approach that we're not currently doing at Afanera, but I still think it's very, very interesting. So that's on the food side. I'm very much interested also in specialty chemicals, especially when it comes to currently I'm looking fairly closely at flavor and fragrances. So a lot of the traditional fragrance manufacturing companies, either rely on chemical synthesis or have to, grow specific crops and then do extractions or have to source from, in the end of the Amazon or in Indonesia, specific exotic flowers for specific scents. And here biotechnology provides us with a tool where we can, use fermentation as a way to create those scents or create those flavors close to the end consumers. So much more reliably without having the environmental impact that is linked with, sourcing those and shipping those to wherever you transform them. And I think, there's a lot of talk about the human microbiome, but obviously animals do have a microbiome. We talked about the plant microbiome, but animals do have a microbiome too. And there are a number of very interesting applications around, animal health here as well.
Okay, so just in the closing moments, as we've talked about throughout the interview a little bit, although we separated out aspects of your career just to discuss the journey, many of your experiences were very overlapped, involved groups literally across the world. For example, you were on the advisory board of the European Commission, overlapping with some of the development and creation of your companies, and at the time with Microbiomes Bioscience, which is in Texas. So how are you able to juggle all of these different responsibilities? And looking back, do you have any advice for people who might be interested in pursuing a number of these paths as well?
That's a great question. I think as PhD students or as, I actually think like the academic training is really good at helping us, source interesting information and relevant information and parse through it. And whenever you get started on your thesis or your PhD project or master's project, whatever that might be, you really have to have this global awareness of your field and its boundaries and interfaces with other things. And I think it's the same in entrepreneurship. I think it's, just keep on being curious, find a way to keep this spark going into entrepreneurship. And that's really all you need and perseverance and, being, being willing to also stay humble and ask for help when from your network when you need to help you go through or understand, you know, specific aspects of the project that you have. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Camille, so much for sharing your perspectives with us today on biotech and entrepreneurship.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to follow Hopkins Biotech Podcast on social media at Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter for updates about upcoming guests. And visit us at HopkinsBiotechPodcast.com to check out our mission and full catalog of episodes. I'm Roshan Chikermain.
And I'm Cynthia Steinhardt.
Thank you for listening.